From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Rebecca Burgess, an analyst who studies veterans in public office at the American Enterprise Institute, and that's a think tank here in Washington. As we commemorate Women's History Month, we examine the record number of female veterans running for elective office. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Elaine Luria, a former surface warfare officer and nuclear engineer for the U.S. Navy. Now, she's running for Congress as a Democrat in this year's midterm elections. Elections for the lower chamber of Congress, or the U.S. House of Representatives, are held every 2 years. Elaine Luria is seeking to capture the seat for the state of Virginia's 2nd District, which is currently held by a Republican. Analysts say women who served in the military are running for elective office in greater numbers than at any time in history. Many broke gender barriers in uniform and think it's time to make their mark in politics. For generations, military veterans who become elected officials have overwhelmingly been male and Republican. But these female veterans, many of whom served in pioneering combat roles in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, are overwhelmingly Democrats and critical of President Trump. Currently, only 4 of the 535 members of Congress are female veterans, 2 Republicans and 2 Democrats. But according to the director of the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University, 25 Democrats and 7 Republicans are now campaigning for the House of Representatives and the Senate. And we are speaking with one of them, Elaine Luria. Elaine Luria served for 20 years as a surface warfare officer and nuclear engineer, deploying 6 times, twice forward deployed on ships stationed in Japan, conducting operations in the Middle East and Western Pacific on destroyers, cruisers, and aircraft carriers. We'll talk with retired Navy Commander Elaine Luria about the factors that motivated her to run for Congress as a Democrat and to what extent her military service played a role in her decision to now serve her country in a civilian capacity. And Elaine Luria joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Carol. Thank you for having me today.
And I'm delighted also to welcome my panelist, Rebecca Burgess. She's a program manager at the American Enterprise Institute.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a delight.
Well, Commander Elaine, we're so happy to have you here. First, I'd like to congratulate you on your service and your career.
Well, thank you.
And tell us, what were the main factors for you that motivated you now to run for elective office?
Well, I think that, like many veterans, trying to continue to serve my community and my country. So when I look back on my career, you mentioned a few of the things that I did over those 20 years, but I was very fortunate to attend the Naval Academy. And the first day as a plebe at the Naval Academy, you learn the mission, which includes to develop leaders for the highest positions of command, citizenship, and government. So the entire time that I served in the Navy in different capacities, I always had in my mind that there was sort of an obligation or an expectation to continue to serve. And as I transitioned out of the Navy and also became a small business owner in my community and got very involved at a local level, I thought that there was no better way in our current political climate where I didn't want to sit on the sidelines. And I thought that this was the time for me to serve. And with my background in the military, national security, and also being a small business owner, I thought that gave me a great foundation to represent the district where I live.
Tell us a little bit about the district where you live. It seems to be there are a lot of veterans or military in your area.
That's true. So the largest naval base in the world, Naval Station Norfolk, is located in our district, along with many other military facilities, both Army, Navy, NASA facilities on the Eastern Shore. So the district encompasses every inch of coastal Virginia. So from the Maryland line to the North Carolina line, it includes the Eastern Shore, which is a very rural, isolated area. So I look at the district really as a microcosm of the whole country. So if you were to find different characteristics across the country, we have very rural areas. We also have urban areas within the city of Norfolk and very suburban type areas within the city of Virginia Beach, which is the largest city in Virginia. So really, as a microcosm of the whole country, I think that issues that you find anywhere in the country, you're going to find similar issues within our district.
I'd like to turn to Rebecca. Rebecca Burgess from the American Enterprise Institute. You're studying veterans who are running for public office. What are your findings about this trend?
We're seeing many more female veterans in particular running. What does your research tell you about why this is happening this particular year?
I can't say particularly why this year, 2018, more veterans are running, except for showing the trend line from 2016, which is when I really started looking at this, which is that veterans returning from the post-9/11 service are now looking at their second service, where they have had immense responsibilities that they have lived up to, and they want to continue it. And so now, as they are transitioned back into civilian life, they are antsy, let us say. They see opportunities and they want to continue to contribute. In 2016, about 30% of the veterans who ran for office were from the Gulf War era, specifically post 9/11. And I think in 2018, we have seen a massive influx of those veterans who are now ready to serve at additional levels.
And what about the rise in the number of females running, you know, the ratio between men and women? And statistics show that it appears that more Democrats seem to be running this time.
Right, which is always something that's going to be noted because it seems so counter. So we have this idea of veterans being very Republican, white, male, which is slightly true, but also not true. Veterans typically have mirrored the nation in terms of being Republican, Democrat, Independent, Libertarian, Blue Dog Democrat, very left Democrat. And this time, however, especially on the Democratic Party side, to recruit Democrats who are veterans because it seems like the best counterweight to current narratives about not only the Democratic Party, but also a very strong counterweight against President Donald Trump and the Republican Party. There's no way you can question the patriotism and the service record of someone who has served the country in a combat zone, or not in a combat zone, but someone who has put on a uniform and made that sacrifice and that oath to serve their country.
That leads me to ask you, Commander Luria, about that particular factor. Many analysts say that some veterans are rather upset about the current administration. Donald Trump as commander-in-chief is seen as perhaps putting the country at risk in some ways. What do you say to that? In other words, what other factors with respect to policies of this current administration may have propelled you to run?
Well, I think in answering that question, I like to go back down to my district. And the current representative in our district says that his job as a leader is to find clarity in chaos. And so I look back over my 20 years, my leading thousands of sailors during my career, and I think that he couldn't be more wrong. My job was never to find clarity in chaos. It was to prevent the chaos in the first place. So when I look at that, I think that that chaos has permeated through many policies and many bills that have been voted on by our current representative. And the people across the district are just not happy with those decisions and how they're being represented. So really, that's what propelled me to throw my hat in and to run and try to serve our district better than he currently is.
And of course, the current representative is a Republican. I'd like to ask you about what issues you think are most important to you and to your second district in Virginia.
I think that there's issues that are important nationally, and also I'll talk about a couple that are very specific to our region. You know, first, I think jobs, looking at better, more well-paying jobs for people in our district. I've listened to our governor over the last few years talk about the disconnect between the workforce that we have and the skills for 21st century jobs and the workforce within the state. 10, 17,000 jobs are unfilled within Virginia because we don't have the workforce that has those skills. And so then if you focus down in our area, I've spoken to people in economic development, both in Norfolk and Virginia Beach, and they say the same thing. One of their biggest challenges in bringing companies and new industries to our area is there's a gap between the workforce that they would need to fill those jobs. So I think addressing that both at the secondary education level and opportunities that are, you know, not four-year college but provide technical and STEM skills to people to be able to broaden that workforce are very important. I also think that, you know, healthcare is important, and that's, you know, a national debate and something that we really need to get to a solution on. And the midterm elections in 2018, you know, changing the makeup of Congress will definitely, you know, help us come to the table to be able to discuss that issue. And, you know, I think that something that's very important about veterans is our entire career, we go through and we serve without asking what your political affiliation is. So I think of myself on the aircraft carrier in the Indian Ocean, and we're simultaneously launching strikes against terrorist targets in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we have a mission to accomplish, and our whole purpose is to accomplish this mission. So I never turned to a sailor next to me and said, are you a Democrat or are you a Republican? Everybody was just on the same team to accomplish the mission. So, you know, I think that that sort of attitude is something that as veterans that we can take to Congress. So thirdly, an issue that, you know, you ask about specific to our region is that sea level rise and recurrent flooding are definitely an issue within our region, and they really are a national security concern because of the fact that we have so many military assets in our region. And it's not something we're going to solve overnight. We're not going to solve this next year or even in a decade. But we need to look at this problem 40 to 50 years out. We need to determine the engineering solutions. We need to determine the resources necessary so that, you know, our military can continue to function and operate out of the facilities within our region. And 40% of our economy is tied back to military and DOD assets within the district. And so it's very important that this is a focus from a national level to make sure that the region has the resources necessary to continue to operate the military forces that are based within the area.
Elaine Luria, I'd like to ask you if you know many other female veterans who are running. Are you, have you formed some kind of a caucus or a group? There are, I guess, somewhere around, is it 35?
Around there is the number. So, of course, we just had the first primary in Texas the other day. So some of the numbers are still speculative because about only 22 states have actually passed their filing deadlines. So we're waiting to see. And so there's a large number floating out there, around maybe even 300 veterans. That's not just 300 female veterans, but 300 veterans overall. But the number which you mentioned is the one that I have also, 30 or so of actual female veterans who are running for Congress.
Do you know one another? Have you sort of met?
Well, I haven't had the opportunity to meet or speak to all 30, but there's two who I am connected with. There's three women from the Naval Academy. There's never been a woman from the Naval Academy elected to Congress, so there's three women. A classmate of mine, class of 97, Amy McGrath, she's running in Kentucky, and then also another Naval Academy graduate, class of 94, Mikey Sherrill, who's running in New Jersey. So the three of us are connected by our common affiliation through the Naval Academy, and we hope that, you know, all three of us will break that record and the first woman Naval Academy graduates to serve in Congress.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Elaine Luria, retired Navy commander, and she's a Democrat running for Congress this year in Virginia's 2nd District. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Rebecca Burgess, an analyst who studies veterans in public office at the American Enterprise Institute. And this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Lemmy Lematoda. He's a loyal listener from Ibadan who resides in Abuja, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And now I'd like to turn to Rebecca Burgess to see if she has a question for Commander Luria.
As you mentioned, I study veterans in office, and one of the things we are studying right now is how do veterans portray their rationale or their public rhetoric for why they are running for Congress. So each veteran has had to make an oath to the Constitution to defend the Constitution. So they are, in theory, very well aware of the nation and the state and the government. But how aware are they of how Congress works? Are they running against Congress? Are they running to be a part of Congress when Congress is the least trusted institution of all of our government institutions? And yet you are coming from the institution, the military, which is the most honored and trusted institution. That juxtaposition is one that fascinates me. And I would love to hear from Elaine how that dynamic works with you in your campaign.
I think when you were asking the question, I drew a clear connection in my head myself, because yes, you've said that, you know, we've all taken an oath to protect and defend the Constitution. And I think we take that very seriously. And, you know, no matter where you served in the military, I served on ships. You know, there's other women in Congress who served in combat roles on the ground. And, you know, when you take that oath, you're not just taking an oath to serve, but you're taking an oath that you would risk your life and do that in defense of your country. And you ask about, well, you know, how maybe some people perceive Congress as broken or dysfunctional, but they perceive the military as, you know, one of the most trusted organizations and, you know, groups of people within our government or within service to our country. So I think it's a clear choice that, you know, someone who's a veteran and who's already made that oath to serve, you know, made that commitment over a period of time to put themselves at risk in dangerous situations would be just the kind of person you want to have in Congress to dispel that thought that we can't get things done. And I would definitely focus on being the kind of person who really wants to sit down and work across the aisle and work with other people, veterans, not veterans, to get things done that are right for the American people and not solely based off of partisan divide in policies.
I think that's definitely speaks to why so many are interested and excited by veterans running for office. As I'm sure you know, there are several different organizations now that have been formed in recent years, especially this year, that are trying to help veterans run for office, identifying specifically that aspect that they have a pre-political, if you will, identity that they can hopefully address or reach to or speak to when they are in Congress and can speak about issues that has nothing to do with whether they're Democrat or Republican. It has everything to do with they know how to speak to each other, apparently. And I think that's wonderful. That would definitely boost the hopes of those organizations, your answer. One other thing that fascinates me very much is, was this desire to serve, as you know, and perhaps as our listeners don't, less than 1% of the American population now volunteers to serve. We've had an all-volunteer force army for going on 40 years. And what's happened in those decades is that fewer and fewer geographically diverse Americans serve, and it's becoming more and more a family tradition. And so one question is, do you go into the service because you already have a tradition of service to public service? Or while you are in the service, does that desire get kindled to continue the service? Does that prompt the desire to continue running afterwards? Mm-hmm. So at what point, as you entered the academy, as you left, or even afterwards?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. And I'm sure that different people, you know, have a combination of both, but, you know, weigh those factors differently. So both my grandfather served in World War II. My grandfather on one side was a Supply Corps officer in the Navy, and my grandfather on the other side was a doctor in the Army Air Corps. So I definitely knew that there was a tradition of service in my family, and all of the men in that generation also, you know, served in the military in different capacities. Going to the Naval Academy, you know, that's a daunting thing to decide when you're a junior in high school, a 16-year-old girl from Alabama, to say, you know, I want to go in the Navy, I want to serve, I want to go on ships, I want to go to these different places around the world. And I think, you know, it takes time once you get into the training to really understand, you know, the magnitude of what you're doing and the responsibility you're going to be given at a very young age. And you ask if that became kindled over time. I think it definitely did. A lot of people think about the military, the Navy specifically, as ships and hardware. And so you were a surface warfare officer and a nuclear engineer. You drove ships, you operated nuclear reactors. But it's not about the steel, it's not about the equipment, it's really about the people that make the military go. And I think I learned, you know, as an ensign and tried to carry this through my whole career, that those people are what was important, and trying to create an environment where people can succeed. And that's really was my focus throughout my time in the Navy. So if I look back on the years that I served, the things that were most important to me were really the people I was able to help along the way. I remember a sailor who came to the ship. I was an ensign. He was a deck seaman, and his job was basically to, you know, scrape paint, keep the ship clean, do very dangerous operations on the flight deck, landing the helicopter. And he wasn't a U.S. citizen. And there's many, many people in the military who are not U.S. citizens. I was very proud when I crossed paths with him a few years later, and I had helped him start along that path to become a U.S. citizen. And then when I crossed paths with him a few years later, because he had gained his citizenship, he had gotten his nursing degree and then gotten commissioned as an officer in the Navy, as a U.S. citizen, and in the nurse corps. I was just very proud, and I have hundreds of stories like that in different capacities along the way of people that I feel I was able to help by creating that environment where they could succeed. So it definitely feeds on itself and kindles itself. And, you know, once you realize that serving is really helping other people, it just perpetuates itself, and you want to continue to do that to the extent possible.
Elaine Lurie, I have a follow-up to what Rebecca asked, and that is how you transitioned, or how you are transitioning from military service to serving in the Congress should you be elected. And that leads me to ask you about your interesting definition of security. You say that in your materials that security not only means that we are providing for the common defense of our nation and have a strong and ready military to ensure the security of our civilians. Security means that we are healthy and have a reliable and affordable choices in health care, And again, you go on to talk about this broader definition of security. I would like you to elaborate on that.
So when I started thinking about, you know, what are the key things that are important that you want to put out as far as your values and how you'll view things through a lens when you make decisions in Congress, I came up with this umbrella of security and equality. And I think that security and equality together really create a road that people are traveling on, a road to prosperity, because, you know, we all want prosperity in the sense that we want a better life for future generations. So I think that our job in government is to tug on that road. Sometimes it might be a windy road for people, but we need to straighten that road and we need to widen that road for people. So when I think about security, you know, being a veteran, people might think, well, she's just talking about the military and she's just talking about the military and border security or security in those concrete terms. But going back to the idea of creating an environment where people can succeed, I really encompass everything that provides people security in their lives. And that's, you know, security in having reliable, affordable health care that people deserve, and having affordable housing, and having a clean environment and clean air and water to breathe, and security in their neighborhoods, being safe against, you know, some of the terrible gun violence things that we've seen recently. So security is really security in everyone's lives at every level. So that's really how I framed that. As a decision maker in Congress, what I would do is I would view everything through this prism of security and equality, and does it lead to more prosperity for the next generation by these choices that we make for the American people?
Well, speaking of violence and the school shooting that we just witnessed in Florida, in addition to many other mass shootings, we saw the president speak about this, that something has to be done in the Congress, and yet, a couple of weeks later, no legislation and no action. Now, I'd like to get your sense of what legislation you would like to see enacted, again, as we witness ever more gun violence in the public schools and in the public square.
You know, when we talk about these incidents, I want to start out, you know, I'm a mother, so I think about, you know, these children who went to school that day, and my heart just sinks when I think about the fact that that could be my daughter someday, that because of a senseless act of violence like this doesn't come home. And I really think that, you know, we need to have safety in our communities. People need to feel safe sending their children to school. You know, your neighbors need to feel safe going to church or their house of worship. Your friends need to feel safe going to a concert or a movie theater. And those are just aspects of our daily lives. And it's really terrible that we have had so many incidents recently where people in those aspects of their daily lives did not have that safety. And these, you know, tragic events happened. So there's things that I think we need to do immediately as far as, you know, common sense gun safety legislation is concerned. I think that we need to immediately repeal the Dickey Amendment, which was passed in 1996, which prevented study of, you know, the effects of guns and gun violence in our communities, that prevented spending any federal funds to collect that data. And so that's a first step to be able to collect that data and use that as, you know, concrete evidence for creating good policies in the future. We need to also implement universal background checks. 93% of the public agrees with that. And I think that in an immediate bipartisan way, we need to move forward and take that step. I also think we need to increase legislation that keeps guns out of the hands of people who have records of domestic violence or violent criminals, and also, you know, people who suffer from mental illness. So taking steps to do that will help keep our communities more safe. I also think we need to look very hard at an assault weapons ban on some of the types of weapons that we've seen in these recent incidents. We had that ban in 1994, and we need to look back at, you know, how that was implemented and whether it was effective. And, I mean, that would be a lofty goal in the current Congress, but it really is the direction that I feel we need to go to keep these, for lack of better terms, weapons of war off of our streets. I mean, I have a lot of experience with guns, having served in the military. I was an expert pistol rifle shot. I stood armed watches myself. As a commanding officer, I had an armory full of, you know, 300 weapons that are similar to this. So I understand the destruction that they can cause. I was responsible for training the 400 sailors who worked for me to use them safely in combat situations. So I understand their importance in the military. And also, you know, as a kid growing up, my dad and I used to go shoot a rifle and shoot bottles out in the woods. So, you know, I understand how guns are important to people and I value that. But I think that these types of weapons of war that have been creating havoc in our communities or just don't have a place on the streets.
Well, Rebecca, Elaine's answer reinforces something you said, that veterans like Elaine, who have this combat experience, familiar with weapons, they're saying something with respect to, let's say, gun safety legislation perhaps carries a little more weight, more credibility, because they know exactly what they're talking about. Do you have another question or comment for Elaine?
Perhaps a comment, which is that historically, when we look at women who have run and who have won their races for U.S. Congress, there has been a consistent thread, actually, in their concern for national security, for what they have actually done for national security. So we are speaking back with Margaret Chase Smith, who is the first female to be elected both to the House and to the Senate. While she was in the Senate, she joins the military. She becomes a lieutenant officer in the reserves of the Air Force. And it is her mission, because she volunteered during World War I. She saw what women could do. She also saw the horrible conditions that could happen in wartime. And so she made it one of her missions, not only to do appropriations work, if you will, but also to help women be more integrated within the military community and things like that, which I think is a very wonderful thread to this narrative that women and the military and Congress have always been this three-pronged thing, if you will, but very powerful and very forceful. So it's not just an act or a piece of clothing, if you will, that they put on to say, see, look at me, I belong in this man's room. It's no, I know what I'm speaking of. I have credibility here. And the American electorate generally responds in that way, it appears, that it's kind of a shortcut to understanding the biography of a candidate to see their military service. And especially in purple districts, they use that as a cue in why they vote for them.
Elaine Luria, analysts are talking about a potential blue wave in the upcoming midterm elections because of disenchantment with policies of the current administration. It appears that Democrats are gaining ground in some special elections, and they predict that possibly there'll be many more Democrats possibly taking over the House of Representatives. But what I want to ask you is, what do you think the impact will be should that occur? Should there be a Democratic House of Representatives or many more Democrats, and particularly women and veterans like yourself? How do you think that would change not only the makeup, but the policies or the decorum of the lower chamber of Congress?
You know, right now we really have a partisan divide, and the numbers are so skewed that we don't have to invite both sides to the table. So anywhere we can get closer to parity in numbers, I think that that's better for the country, because I think that at that point we have to have serious discussions about legislation and what's best. When I look at, you know, some recent things that happened in the U.S. Senate, I was very proud that both of our senators, Senator Kaine and Senator Warner, were part of a bipartisan group of about a dozen senators on each side who came together to try to find solutions to keep the ball moving forward in a difficult situation. And I really tie that back to, you know, I heard Senator Kaine describe it the other day, that that's the Virginia political way. Both Senators Kaine and Warner were governors of Virginia, and during the times that they served, they both had the House of Delegates, the state Senate, and neither of them had both at both times that were the same party as they were as Democrats, but they still had to govern. And I think that once the 2018 midterms shake out and however the numbers end up, I would like to see them closer to the middle. Of course, I would like to see more Democrats, but just the understanding that we're going to have a number where both sides need to have a voice and need to work together to create legislation that's good for the country.
So I wanted to add some numbers perhaps to this discussion so we could understand a little bit better, not just the women running for office, but just the blue wave, if you will, and what that looks like. So overall, candidates on the Democratic Party are up, both male and female. That's going to be something that will be a challenge for the female candidates, because while something like 126% rise since 2016 in male Democrat candidates are on the table, about 146% rise on the female side. So there is definite weight to the rise of women candidates, which is a wonderful thing. Definitely more on the Democratic side. And that's rather standard for a midterm election in which one party has control of both branches, if you will. So part of that is a little bit normal, where it's maybe a little less exciting or taking a little bit of wind out of the sails is to look back to the 1992 election and then the 2006 election, both of which featured either the Year of the Woman, as so-called afterwards, and the 2006, which is the Fighting Dems, that Nancy Pelosi was interested in bringing Democrat veterans on board. In both cases, it didn't pan out as well. Not as many actually won their races, but it did result in a slight net increase in both veterans and and both Democrats in office.
And as we close, Elaine Loria, I'm going to give you the last word. Any final thoughts you'd like to share with us with respect to your run for Congress and your aspirations?
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today. And I think that throughout this discussion, it's really highlighted how veterans have a commitment to serve and that this is really a calling for people. And I've felt for a long time that serving my community and, like I said, during my time in the military, creating an environment where people could succeed was very important to me. And, you know, moving forward into the future, if I am elected to Congress, that'll be my priority, is really to create that environment for the people in our district. And as we discussed, through this lens of, you know, security and equality and tugging on this road to make it straighter, to make it wider, for more people to have better opportunities for future generations.
Elaine Loria is a retired Navy commander, and she's a Democrat running for Congress in Virginia's 2nd District in the upcoming midterm elections. Well, Commander Loria, thank you so much for taking time to be with us and sharing your terrific story.
Thank you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guests. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. And joining me on the program was American Enterprise Institute's program manager, Rebecca Burgess. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.